So fantastic start of the discussion in the previous panel. So I want to build a little bit on that. So my first topic of discussion is going to be focused around cedent and sponsor needs. And I'm going to start off with Corey at the far end, and I'm going to ask you about a little bit about the pricing. What about the 2023 pricing? What can we expect in 2024? Is it a continuation? How can we actually, what have we missed in 2023 that could be seen in 2024?
Okay, so there's a couple questions in there. I'll start first with, you have to acknowledge that 2023 was just a remarkable year. So I started in this business in 1999 when we had 5 deals that the entire industry fought over. The same number of rangers, same number of folks trying to sign these deals, but there were only 5. And last year we had 69, just in the 144A Kappa market, let alone what's in the collateralized remarket, let alone what's in the sidecar market. So I think it speaks volumes to the consistency of the space. If you look at the last 4 years, we've been hovering consistently at 95 to 100 billion of total ILS capital in a heavy, heavy loss environment, which means that the investors, some of which we just saw on the panel, have stepped up and reloaded capital at a time when they've either lost or are expecting to lose because capital is being trapped. At the same time, you've seen reinsurance capital dip way down and work its way back up, but we've had more consistency in the availability of capital. So I think because of the availability of capital and because of some of the dynamics in 2023, and we can get into that a little bit later, last year was just record. We had every different type of cedent that you could ask for, insurers, reinsurers, public sector, sovereigns, corporates, who's not using it in a way. And I think you've got that representation here on the panel as well. So, but I think some of the things for 2024 is we're a supply and demand market, just like the traditional market. So availability of capital affects pricing. But I think what people in the industry don't understand about ILS capital is how you frame where pricing falls. And it looks between kind of two barriers, like they don't go outside of these barriers. Where is capital markets pricing for non-ILS products? Because I could take that dollar of capital and move it from ILS into these other investments. Or where traditional reinsurance pricing is when I put it into insurance exposure. And we kind of barrier ourselves between those two levels. And you have to think about it from highs and lows. So sometimes our pricing, if I take capital markets pricing is high and reinsurance pricing is low, they need to have more pricing than what traditional reinsurance pricing is providing because, again, how do they have to justify beyond the low correlation that they're getting an adequate return. But when we go to the flip, what you see is that it can also be a justification that they're lower pricing than where the traditional market is simply because of how the broader capital markets are doing. So what they pay attention to is more dynamic than maybe what a traditional reinsurer's constraints are. And I think it's further, not exacerbated, but further enhanced by the fact that these investors are not thinking from a solvency perspective because of the size of their investments. You know, it's more of an earnings impact. So I think moving into 2024, we have seen positive headwinds throughout 2023 relative to the traditional market. So ILS just moves faster in making pricing corrections. And when we come down, it can be particularly attractive. We've seen that in 2023, and we think we're poised for a very positive year from a cedent perspective in pricing, both availability, capital, and pricing.
Thank you. Thank you, Corey, for the elaborate explanation. And Stefan, anything to add from the perspective of the investors referring to pricing and how you've seen the pressures associated with it?
From the previous panel, I always struggle when we talk about the investor, actually, because the investor base in cat bonds specifically is huge. And it ranges from retail platforms, banking platforms, allocating large amounts into UCITS vehicles. And by the way, a third of the cat bond money provided today is coming from UCITS vehicles, which is heavily driven by retail money, actually. So it's one investor base. Then you have the pension world that does allocate and acts differently in terms of what they expect from a return and a pricing perspective. You have long-term asset owners like family office endowments, foundations. They have a different behavior. And then finally, you have also insurance companies who allocate quite substantial amounts into the cat bond space. And they do that for very different reasons because they can optimize balance sheet. So the four groups I described, they come with a different view on pricing and the relativity, right? And as Corey mentioned, there's another element. Often cat bonds specifically are compared to high yield bonds, and the spread differential that you can have at a certain point in time is driving also allocations. So that's just to qualify that when we talk about investors, it's not unique one investor type. It's a very broad range of people looking at it. What we see at the moment is pricing levels are still attractive. We will see how things evolve into 2024, because at the moment we still see what we would describe as a sound amount of money that looks to be allocated in the cat bond world. At the same time, we look at an issuance pipeline that is very, very sound as well. And will there be an equilibrium over the first or second quarter? I don't know. At the moment, though, we see still spread tightening, and I would confirm that. Now, is that unique across the cat bond space? I don't think so, or we don't think so, actually. We see more tightening in index-based bonds, for example, than we see in UNL bonds. We see more tightening in shorter durations or shorter maturity bonds than in longer maturity bonds. So there is a difference in pricing that we can observe in the market.
Fantastic. Thank you, Stefan. Lynn, you're a little bit outside of the normal range, and what can you tell us a little bit what made you, and I'm sure since we talked about pricing and seedent and sponsor needs and everything else, tell us a little bit about how you came to the market and why you did the cat bond that you've done within your organization.
Sure. So we have a very large portfolio of real estate investments in the United States. It's very geographically diverse. And we finance most of that with commercial mortgage-backed securities, which carry very large cat insurance requirements. We have to buy up to a 1 in 475-year California earthquake cover, and we have to buy 1 in 10,000-year wind cover. And last year, given the condition of the markets, we weren't able to buy enough coverage in the traditional market. So what we did was we went to the cat bond market to buy the high excess layers of our insurance tower. So with respect to Corey's comments about the difference between reinsurance pricing and cat bond pricing, we are very sensitive to that. And every year we look at the comparison if we're considering doing an additional issuance. Generally speaking, the reinsurance pricing for us will be lower than the cat bond pricing, but last year it was effectively infinite because the capacity just wasn't available.
Fantastic, fantastic. Thank you very much. Michael, what are you seeing from a global perspective? I know you have a broader view and everything else. Can you add a little bit on pricing needs overall or from the point of view of needs of the market?
Yeah, thank you. And first of all, I just want to thank all the investors in the room. We've reached our 10th year of doing World Bank cat bonds. I think we've done about $4 billion of risk transfer. And obviously, your support has been incredible. The flexibility you've shown to take new risks and the support you've shown, we really appreciate. I know that there are parts of this country where investing to make the world a better place is a bad thing to do. So if you can't admit that's what you're doing for regulatory reasons or political reasons, I understand. But you really are when you're supporting our deals investing to make the world a better place. Because you can imagine from the perspective of a Ministry of Finance in a country, let's say a small island state, or a country where a very, very significant concentration of wealth and assets is in the capital city. That Ministry of Finance is so highly exposed to natural events, and being able to hedge ahead of time some of that risk is just invaluable. So thank you very much. I think on the issue of pricing, we're obviously buying reinsurance from this market, so lower prices are better. But at the same time, I think we generally take the market where it is. Capacity is also extremely important to us, because when we work with a government, we can be working for months, and that government may go to Parliament to get its budget for the cat bond transaction approved. And after that entire process, to go to the market and find the capacity is not there is a significant negative for us. So we always believe in a healthy market is the best for us. We need both capacity and effective pricing. So I think we love those periods when both things are working in our favor. Pricing is positive for us, and capacity is strong. But we ultimately take the market as it is when we do transactions.
Fantastic, thank you for that. And Michael, since I have you on, so let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk a little bit about growth. Where do you see growth coming from the cat bonds? Do you see emerging risks? And I know we've already touched base a little bit on cyber, so we won't dive too deep on it, but we'll mention it just because there's another panel. So tell us a little bit at a global level. What do you see from the growth perspective?
Yeah, I mean, luckily I know nothing about cyber, so I won't have to silence myself on that. I think we see a variety of things. I would say there's definitely you're going to see us bring new perils, which means new regions, and also new types of perils. Right now we've been, other than a pandemic transaction we did, all of that $4 billion risk has been named storm and earthquake. So you'll definitely see us bringing drought, could see us bringing flooding, new regions that haven't been in the cat bond market before. So definitely new perils are coming. With those new perils comes, again, us asking for your flexibility around new data sources, new modeling. I think that is something certainly we're trying to get a handle on. We hope the industry is getting a handle on of exactly how we can take advantage, for instance, of some new technologies around observation of natural disaster aftermath. How the ILS market can absorb that into the sort of probabilistic modeling that's needed. I think that new data sources, new ways of looking at modeling are going to be important. And finally, I would just raise the issue of new products. I think people, you will have observed some very limited connections growing between the sovereign credit market and ILS in terms of things like hurricane clauses. This is so far very light. I think a typical hurricane clause is just a deferral of interest for a short period of time. And in general, I would say sophisticated credit investors can handle that kind of natural disaster issue through just regular old bond math. But I think there's a desire to increase that sort of convergence of the two products, where you're talking about sovereign bonds that actually have a real market risk transfer aspect, not just a deferral, but perhaps a write down of some of the principal. It would be interesting to me to see which investor base moves into that market, whether it's EM credit or whether it's ILS, because I think there would be a tendency for ILS investors to say, nah, that's not me. We don't do credit. We only focus on insurance risk, and that I would understand an ILS investor taking that point of view. But I think you might be missing out on an opportunity, and so I think you're going to see new perils, new data, and potentially new products coming out.
Thank you. Corey, I'll throw it over to you. What do you see from the growth perspective for 2024?
Sure. So part of the growth that we've seen the last 2 years has been driven from the inflationary impact. So if you need to keep your ratings or bolster your ratings or your financial strength as your total insured values have increased, then you had to buy more limit. And that was kind of a catalyst for a large number of the sponsors that we've seen. I think we had 13 last year and a similar number the prior year. And that's a huge amount of growth and cedent activity. They were using, you know, it was a point where, yes, they could manage the market environment with their traditional, with the existing program, but then expanding it, it became a time to look at alternative sources. I do think that there's still a sentiment in the market that has been an overhang from how traditional losses were paid for COVID, but also just how your relationship with your reinsurers, is it really a relationship or is it more of a one-way relationship when the market's soft and then when the market's hard, you can't leverage into that relationship? Either, irrespective of whether you had losses or not, I think there's a lot of cedents saying, I don't know, is this more transactional in my relationship with my traditional reinsurers? And so I feel that there's been a shift of sponsors saying, I want to have a deeper pool of capital, which is why this space was created. And I want to, you know, not have so much leverage or lack of leverage with certain markets. I want to kind of dilute and expand my program. I also think that there's an opportunity. So the first panel mentioned some comments about concerns about the frequency of losses. And I think the theme that I'm starting to see within Guy Carpenter and with GC Securities is we also need to start relooking at volatility covers, whether that comes in aggregate, whether that's a frequency cover. You know, there has been a push to raise retentions generally by the industry, whether it's ILS or by the traditional market. So 70% of North America clients had their retentions raised last year. And since 2014, we've had 125% increase in the return periods in Europe. Those are big numbers. And so now clients are facing with higher retentions, concerns about needing innovation and volatility covers. And I think that there's a way that you can share that volatility, not necessarily first dollar, but you can share part of it if you're very creative in the structures. And this whole marketplace has been incredibly innovative in looking at those type of covers. And so I promote to the community that we continue to focus on that. I also have a personal view that I think that you cannot look at the amount of rate income that's coming through the insurance company. So it takes them longer to push down the higher rates in the reinsurance market and to reflect the losses to get the rates approved by the individual states in the US and then other jurisdictions. But that rate action has started meaningfully, and I think you're going to see a lot more profitability come through. And I think that that's an opportunity for the sidecar market as well to see maybe kind of a resurrection and an expansion versus kind of where it is right now, which is there's still representation of it, but 3 years ago it was growing significantly. I think you're probably 18 months out from significant opportunities from an investor perspective in that format.
Stefan, from an investor perspective, the sentiment is up. We've had a 2023 benign year, cat year, we can call it. So any interest in new geographies, any interest in something other than, let's say, the normal cat bonds, anything that you've seen from that perspective?
Probably I'm a bit of the party pooper now, but I try to address 2 points, actually, and I think both Corey and Michael made a very, very interesting comments. Probably first of all, what we hear and see from all the different investor bases is, what are they looking for when they do invest into ILS, especially cat bonds? It's predictability of outcomes. So that's what investors want. And they want to have a certainty of what those products deliver in terms of addition to a larger portfolio, actually. So when you look at that, I think the cat bond market as such actually is not particularly keen in certain investor bases to take on cyber exposure. We heard it earlier from a number of managers, and I can line myself up into the same group, actually. We cannot allocate to cyber bonds at the moment. However, to your point, Michael, we see emerging a new group of investors. They are not necessarily ILS managers who do buy these bonds. And that's great because this largens up the investor base, actually. So probably we don't always have to think too narrowly about ILS investors themselves when we look at bringing new products to market. Secondly, I think on the question of frequency risk transfer, and I think this is very interesting. Again, I'm of the opinion, and this is what we hear from our investors, that frequency cover is not what our investor base is looking for, because again, the modeling uncertainty is relatively high. Hence, you have a volatility in the outcomes. However, the sidecar market, I think, is a brilliant outlet for those kind of covers, because there you can align interest between the reinsurance balance sheet or the insurance balance sheet and the investor. And the investor base there is a bit different. They can accept volatility. They know what they do and they know what they take on. There, the question then becomes, is the price right for the risk you're taking? And that's a completely different discussion than on the cat bond side, where you have a different type of portfolio construction.
Thank you, thank you. Lynn, now you've done on the cat bond side, so you've done different tranches for the peril. Walk us through your thinking around why you did that and how does that actually work on your end?
So as I mentioned before, we basically are incorporating our cat bonds into our insurance purchasing strategy. And so we effectively have, I think of it as three separate towers. We buy wind risk, we buy California quake risk, and then we buy what we call all other perils. So because we have those separate, when we were fitting the cat bond tranches into our towers, we wanted to have separate pieces. And also our understanding was that there's investors that have different appetites. Some may have a lot of CalQuake experience or exposure. And then on the wind side, we were able to provide something that was a significant diversifier because most of our wind risk is Hawaii from a modeling perspective, whereas most cat bond investors have mostly Florida wind risk. So it was basically because of how it fit into our traditional insurance structure.
Fantastic, fantastic. Thank you. So a little bit about 2023. So let's say we touch base on the coverage needs, we touch base a little bit on the frequency. So speaking of frequency, so PCS has actually tagged 74 events for 2023. So it was the busiest year in the history of PCS. Now about 57 of them were SCS. 21 of them, and that's a large number, were above $1 billion. So we've got some huge numbers talking about the frequency side of that. Now, within this entire environment, we've also had, and you've mentioned the Hawaii area, you've had the first wildfire in Hawaii. You've had the first tropical storm on the Pacific coast. You've had a number of events that kind of resonated that weren't actually forefront at the beginning of the year, but now we're like, okay, those are $1 billion events. What are we talking from the coverage needs at that point? What peril with these kind of secondary perils in play? I know we've heard from the first panel that they don't want to have the frequency. However, the frequency is there. Are we seeing anything in a cat bond market that addresses this? Are we staying away? How are we trying to actually attack this? Corey, can you start the conversation a little bit and let's dive in a little bit deeper on this?
Sure. I think there are creative ways that, and to be clear, we talk a lot about the modeling of the risk, but I have not seen, particularly among the ILS specialist managers, they are not in isolation looking just at the modeling. They are looking at experience analysis and inflation adjusting it and looking at exposure changes. They take views on what type of year it might be. So are there climate aspects that could say, why is it that, I think you said 57, if I'm correct, SCS events happened last year. Whereas when you look at the losses that, so last year, you know, wasn't quite $100 billion in aggregate, I think it was slightly under that, I think 94-ish, if I'm correct. But it was such a larger proponent being SCS. But if you looked at the prior years, it was a smaller component. They were always there, but just what is it about that climate year that has made it be more active? And so I think that you can build the products. I think what the investor community is saying, we don't want to be first dollar loss. We don't want to be close to first dollar loss, but maybe we will provide smarter volatility covers, but we're not going to, you know, nick down as low as that we might have been. And so I definitely see the demand among Guy Carpenter's client base for enhancing how severe convective storm is covered, and how it can be covered, and getting capacity. And when you get capacity, it helps them from pricing. But there is a little bit of a pullback from an interest in that particular peril, simply just because you had larger loss activity. But this community has never stepped back when we've had large hurricane losses. In fact, we figure out a way to move forward and dive into that. And so I think that for some of these secondary perils, we should definitely, you know, not be necessarily pulling back. I think there's a huge difference between severe convective storm and wildfire. And I don't think that the loss experience relative to the modeling there's a wide gap there, and I think climate is exacerbating it dramatically. So I was reading an article earlier this week, if many of you saw it, that we're talking about super El Niños in effect. And I guess Chile has been dealing with a very devastating wildfire as a result of that. And wildfires, I think, we'd all talked about rising sea levels from flooding as a result of climate change, but I think wildfire is the other really, really difficult peril at this point. And so that one, I think, goes into its own special case. But it's these sources of unexpected losses, which creates problems for capital markets providers providing capacity. They just want to say, I'm willing to take the risk. I just need to understand what the scope of the risk. And I feel like SCS is one that we can structure, and there's enough history that we can manage it. But wildfires popping up in places that we've never thought about, or having risks that we just didn't think were as meaningful as they were, I think is ones that causes capital to pause on the scope of risk taking they take.
If I can,
yeah.
Is it on?
Yeah.
I think when you look at other areas like Europe, what we've seen in 2023 is Germany for the first time woke up. So some of you may know I'm from Germany, actually. So I'm not very, friendly with my home country normally. But I think for the first time we saw a bond issued in Germany that also covers flood. And I think that's a great sign, because for many years, the traditional reinsurance market was probably too competitive. But I think with the different issues we had in Europe over the last few years, being inflation on the one side, but also loss experience on the other side, I think some of the ceding companies are now looking not just at, okay, how can I diversify my reinsurance panel, but also accept that the pricing differential might be there, but it's a great source of new capital coming in, actually. So we do see the capital markets, and specifically the cat bond market, being able to address some of the new risk is probably the wrong word, but risk that has not been in the cat bond market before. So hence, there is a way. It's not that the cat bond market is not open. It's just how do you structure it, actually, and how you model it.
Not only that, but you're also talking about what's the actual pricing that you're attaching to this new risk that's being associated, right? Michael, anything to add from this perspective on the global level? We've started off the year with an earthquake in Japan area, Chilean fires and everything else. You've got the floods in Australia and New Zealand on a recurring yearly basis at that point. So there's more and more high severity events throughout the world that kind of stand out more. Not only that, but you tackle on everything else. You tackle the inflation on the value of property and everything else. Where do we sit on all of this?
The World Bank, we have 189 member governments, so we will never have a year where we don't have extremely high frequency of events. And such a large number, highly vulnerable to more than one, even natural disaster event. There's always a tension when you're doing government-based reinsurance transactions around frequency, because then for a lot of governments, the nightmare scenario is to do a transaction that doesn't pay out, right? Because people may say, and may even come back a few years later and audit the transaction and say, you paid this much in premiums, what did you get back? And just saying we got back the peace of mind may not be a sufficient answer. So there's always going to be frequent events in our member governments, and there's a strong desire to see payouts. And sometimes that payout amount isn't even that relevant. It's the idea to be able to say that the insurance worked, even if the amount of the payout is quite small. It's kind of like if you saw Austin Powers, where Dr. Evil is going to extort the world for $1 million. And people say, it can be that way in the government insurance. You might say, an event occurred, we got a $1 million payout, or we got a $500,000 payout. It may still have very significant benefits to the government. So there's definitely that desire to cover high frequency events. We have generally taken care of that desire outside the cat bond market, because our understanding is that cat bond investors don't necessarily want to be bothered with losing $500,000 every once in a while, whereas I think reinsurers can simply price that in and work that better. So we definitely see a place for products that cover higher frequency events, but it's probably, unless you folks tell me I'm wrong, it's probably not the cat bond market.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to throw one at everyone and say, was 2023 an actual hard market, or was it a rebalance year? What do you think about that? Corey, you want to chip in from the capital perspective?
This is one I haven't actually, I'm thinking on the fly here of exactly what I want to say. It's definitely a harder market. Is it the hardest market that we face? No, but the market is just so different from when we faced other stress time periods because of the depth of capital, the diversity of deals we're doing, and the knowledge that's in the space. But I'd say in a relative sense, yeah, it was definitely a harder market. I would actually argue that 2022 was harder, more challenging to structure and place risk than I felt like it was in 2023. And that's mainly, again, I talked about the speed with which capital markets changes its opinion on availability, capital, and the pricing. And they just make it very rapidly, whereas the traditional market kind of is just very slow. It's like a ramp. You're kind of coming down or walking up, and so they're not as immediately painful, but they don't change courses quickly. Whereas the capital markets just says, oh, done, let's move to wherever we're going to be. And I felt like that shift happened in 2022, and it was concurrent with the interest rate increase in March. Like I call April 1st of 2022 was an April Fool's joke that wasn't a joke. Like, we kept wondering what's going on here. Why is the feedback that we're getting and all these deals that are in the pipeline that are coming and what capacity we have and where that pricing needed to be, and it's all because the end capital money was making decisions very quickly as they were evaluating what does interest rate changes mean for all their other segments, because feds don't do a great job at historically managing their interest rate movement cycles to prevent recessions. And then once you go into recessions, you've got to think about credit events, and then when you have governments moving rates faster than others, you get strong dollars. So they have all this like change happening, and they then demand change very quickly into our space. So I actually argue that 2022 was harder than 2023, but on a relative sense, yes, I would consider this a harder market than what we've seen probably over the last 10 years. I don't know if it's the hardest.
We had an event last week internally, and I'm lucky to work still with Dirk Lohmann. Some of you may know he structured one of the first cat bonds ever, and he's been in the industry for a way longer than probably most of us, and certainly me. But I've been in industry now for more than 25 years, and I have only seen two hard markets, actually. So, and we then started to debate what is a hard market, actually, and probably this goes to what you said, Corey. And usually, what we then came down to is it's a confluence of different things, actually. It's a confluence of, okay, we have the capital markets reacting to something externally very severely. So can be inflation, can be inflation and interest rates going up very, very severely, actually. We've had also the conclusion that you need to have an industry that is depleted of capital. So that was the second ingredient for a hard market, actually. And what does depleted of capital mean? You can have a temporary depletion of capital, or you have a longer term a depletion of capital, which means there's not sufficient capital in the market. And then thirdly, you need probably a triggering event, actually. And we saw that when you think about it in 1992, obviously, with Hurricane Andrew. We saw it probably around 2003-04 with Katrina, Rita, Wilma. And we saw it, and I would agree, end of 2022, because we were in a very strong inflationary environment. Interest rates soared up from basically negative zero to now 5% or more. And we had Hurricane Ian. Now, was it the hardest market ever? No, it was not, because Hurricane Ian, look, what was Hurricane Ian? It was 48 billion, you tell me, you know better than I. A 48 billion market event, right, as of the latest estimates. At the moment when it made landfall, people thought it would be rather somewhere between 60 and 70 billion. But the impact on the Swiss Re cat bond index, for example, today we know it's probably around 2%. So it's not a huge, massive event. Still, I think what we saw is a huge spike because balance sheet at that very moment were weakened and reinsurance did not have the risk-bearing capacity due to the increase of interest rates to take on much more risk that they should have, actually. Hence, it created a short, very, very hard market. But I think we're in a very attractive pricing environment still, but we're not in a hard market, I don't think so.
I would just add, though, it's ILS is doing what we wanted it to do 30 years ago, which was to dampen the volatility by expanding the pool of capital. So when you have these shock events, it ripples out. And I actually think that the fact that we haven't been harder, you know, I would say that truly hard markets were 1992, 2000, and 2005. And then we've had cycles where it's gotten harder and then softer. But that's what the whole premise of ILS coming in and helping the traditional reinsurers was to dampen that volatility. That doesn't mean that cedents like the pricing at the current levels, but that was the premise.
True, very true, very true. And to add to what you were talking about, the capital needs coming inside the market, I think with releasing some of the reserves from Hurricane Ian and with constant influx of capital, I think it's not a shock like we've seen after Andrew or after any other big events to actually have a whole lot of capital all at once come into the market. I think it's more of a steady flow throughout. And like you made a very good point, Corey, that it's mature enough, the ILS sector, to actually do what we wanted it to do at this point. Michael, anything on that perspective from the what drives the capital at a global level?
Yeah, I mean, all I can say is from our perspective, you know, these we come at this. I mean, those of us who work on this team at the World Bank, we come on this from sovereign supranational bond issuance, where the market is always open to us. So it's been an education process in the last 10 years to go through these cycles. We did the Pacific Alliance cat bond, the four nation cat bond. And our order book was, I think, just under 2 billion of orders. Those were great days. You know, we priced, I think the total size of transaction was 1.2 billion on a $2 billion book. The book was, we could have closed the books after a few days. You know, those were great days. We've also had transactions that are much, much harder to place in the market. And it is difficult from a planning perspective to handle that, because you can imagine, again, the government wants to have certainty. The other thing that makes it hard is we had a new boss come into our group, very interested in this market, and met a bunch of the investors in the market. And one investor said that at that point it was a $30 billion market, said your deals could easily be 10%, maybe slightly over 10%. So the capacity is there for over 10% of a $30 billion market. A few months later, we had our first transaction, and the country wanted to place at least $500 million, and suddenly we were told that, you know, that it's going to be very, very difficult to place $500 million. So there was a lot of surprise. You know, managerial surprise is a big problem we have to manage when things like that happen. So in response to that, you know, we are trying to be as evangelical as possible in this market to try to get investors to, our regular bond investors, to look at the market, to allocate money to the market, because we think this is such a valuable tool for developing countries. And having a level of capacity in this market which is constant, which means we can do a $500 million deal on any day of the week, would be so, so valuable that all I can say is to all the investors in this room, if you want any help from us in terms of trying to attract capital from investors, we stand ready to do that, to go and talking about what we're doing. Those who don't mind investing for the good of the planet, we're happy to go to talk to them, because we really want to see that capacity become stable.
Thank you, Michael. Lynn, anything to add from your perspective? What drives some of the capital needs for Blackstone?
Well, I think that we approach the capital question a little bit differently than perhaps some of the insurance companies do. The way that we think about it is, when you invest in real estate, it's typically highly leveraged, and Blackstone uses commercial mortgage-backed securities. So we look at our insurance costs, particularly the high excess insurance costs for CAT exposure, as almost an incremental cost of our CMBS financing. So that's how it factors in.
Thank you. Okay, we've got about 15 minutes left. I wanna open it up to some of the questions for the audience. Can we get a mic?
I can just speak loudly, if that's okay.
Okay, let's go with that for the first one.
More efficient.
Yeah.
I'm curious, each of your perspective on the general state of the earthquake insurance market and how that works for you specifically as a cedent or as an investor or a broker or the bank.
Fully. Yeah, that's right.
Anyone want to start off? Earthquake person?
I mean, I can take that.
Yeah.
Definitely directed at you.
Okay.
Thank you.
We used to rely on a very large MGA in California for most of our earthquake cover, because we have to buy a lot, as I mentioned earlier, one in 475 years. And last year, we definitely saw that dry up. And it's interesting, because we haven't had, I guess I should knock on wood, but we haven't had a California earthquake in quite a while that was very severe. So that was one of the big drivers for us to go to the cat bond market. Was so that we could get that capacity that wasn't available in the market.
I think there's a lot of providers there that are stepping in to provide capacity. From governmental effect, you've got the CEA that's trying to make it available to the residential community. There's a lot of E&S to direct insurance type contracts and carriers that are trying to write it. There's probably a little bit of a rub in the sense that the pricing of the hedging capacity that's coming from ILS and traditional reinsurance and how you're passing it down at the same time people have always been struggling with affordability of that coverage, and now with the inflationary impact at this point, it's just kind of put it on steroids that many people have to, in essence, gamble that there's not going to be an event because they haven't seen one meaningfully for, 20 to 25 years? So, you know, I think that there is availability of capital that, you know, a lot of people are very focused on those markets, and I've seen definitely some of those carriers grow quite substantially, but there's a mismatch there between, you know, how they need to have the capital to support them to write it versus what people are willing to pay. And that's not uncommon to earthquake. You've got the same thing going on with you know, policies exposed to named storm. And you know, I think you laser in Florida and the dramatic rise of rates that have occurred there, you know, coupled with the regulatory action, that legislative action that's taken place in that state to eliminate or reduce what we call social inflation or fraud down to kind of levels that you can see more broadly in across the U.S. But they're still facing, you know, quite sizable, you know, premium increases. So it's a little bit consumer driven, but it's also, you know, it's not for the lack of trying of people trying to bring product to cover it.
If I could just add to that, those when you mentioned like the CEA and equivalent organizations at Florida, and you talked about E&S carriers, those are really designed, the market's very segmented, so those are designed for residential cover, not, you know, in our case, commercial real estate cover. And E&S carrier, we have limited ability to use E&S carriers to maintain lender compliance. So, you know, so it's very much a tale of two markets in that respect.
I do think that that's helped propel, and you see it now more on the retail level, you know, through the insurance market more than you've ever have, but that's why you see the rise of parametrics as well. So different ways that people are willing to accept their coverage, and speed of payment is very important. So, and you're definitely experienced at this. You started with parametric. You're doing indemnity coverage now. It doesn't mean they won't ever consider parametric again. It's just they have to look at the attributes of what they're covering and the cost of it. And, you know, most clients want indemnity coverage if they can get it, but there are clients that could get it, but ultimately don't want to because they like how any source of loss can contribute to, you know, the payment that I'm receiving on the parametric side. So I've definitely seen that that market has grown quite substantially down even into the retail level.
And for commercial real estate, we can't really use the parametrics because for CMBS lender compliance purposes, they won't count those towards lender compliance because they're too concerned about the basis risk. So we'd love to get that changed if we can get the support of the industry to change it.
Fantastic. Right there in the back.
I believe Stefan had said that they're seeing a growth of retail investors through USIP products for cat bonds. Do you think that that's a speculative play from investors or a personal hedge that they're trying to put on? And then more broadly, if I was to create a cat bond ETF, is that something that you all would view as a positive or a negative?
Well, I can go for the first question. On the second one, I almost refer to the Swiss representatives in this room because that's the index that's available today. But for the first question, the way retail investors come into cat bond investments is through wealth management bank platforms, actually, right? So it's not the retail investor itself choosing, okay, I'm invest into this fund. It's usually a wealth management mandate that goes and adds cat bonds to what they offer to the retail client. So that's probably to qualify how this works. This also explains the UCITS background of that money. Now, that's not an opportunistic phenomenon that we see. It's a phenomenon that we've seen for quite a while. So our investor base has always been strongly, I wouldn't say driven, but has been strongly made up of large European banking platforms with whom we've worked now for probably some of them 8 to 10 years. And they have been large investors in those funds, which means it's not an opportunistic play. They have early on realized the value of decorrelation, and they have also early realized that, let's say, that fixed income alternative with the volatility that's compared to high yield, for example, much lower, is a very, very helpful portfolio addition.
I still think that when they are saying retail, they're really meaning very, very sophisticated, you know, investors. You know, it's high net worth individuals that, you know, their wealth manager is putting them into this. We're not run of the mill retail, and I don't think we want to go there because I don't know if they have the sophistication to understand all of the risk attributes of the space. So I think they've been very prudent as the investors have been very prudent as they've expanded the sources and source of capital.
Any additional questions? Okay. So before we got a couple of minutes left, before we conclude, any parting thoughts for 2024? I know we've seen supply and demand. There's always a balance around it. What can we leave for 24? What can we expect for 2024 from that perspective?
Can I rebound on one thing? And I'd like to hear Michael's view, because I found your question on earthquake interesting. And we focused strongly on the US. Now, in 2023, though, we have seen a huge catastrophe in Turkey, which highlighted a few issues, right? And earthquake risk is a strongly transferred risk into the ILS markets, actually. And it's not just California, it's Japan. And essentially, we could see more risk being transferred. However, very often it comes down, if it was on a UNL basis, can we properly assess the risk? And Turkey highlights the problem very well, actually. The building code standards are probably not the same than they are elsewhere. We have not the same data available, hence parametric becomes indeed a very, very interesting way of transferring risk, actually. And I could imagine that at your end, these are things you're contemplating, and I know you're working on a few transactions in that regard.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think earthquake, we find earthquake is a risk that you folks can take, broadly speaking, in parametric form. For a government, of course, particularly a Ministry of Finance, there is really no exact indemnity option. I mean, they're insuring their whole fiscal position, so it's not really an issue for them of choosing between indemnity and parametric. It's almost always gonna be either parametric or a form of parametric, like modeled loss transaction. So we have a pipeline of transactions that will be, probably in terms of volume terms, heavy on earthquake risk for 2024 and 2025.
Okay. I want to thank the panel at this point. Thank you, everyone, and enjoy the next break. Thank you very much.